Okay. So this morning I would like to talk about karma. And the inspiration for talking about it was last weekend I was talking to one of the people who comes and sits with us a lot for years. She's been coming. And she asked one of her questions of me. And she has this wonderful way of asking questions. She used to come a lot on Thursdays when I taught Thursdays, the intro class and Thursday kind of more beginners kind of class. And I would offer some teaching, some instruction, some ideas of how to bring mindfulness in different parts of life. And if she's there, inevitably she'd raise her hand. And I would be very eager to hear what she had to say, and also kind of at the same time kind of gulp, oh no. Because she was then a social worker at a local hospital, county hospital. And she worked often in the emergency room as a social worker, and she kind of was in the front line of meeting people who had terrific tragedies. I don't have to kind of go through a list of them, but, you know, unspeakable tragedies. So here I was doing the intro class in mindfulness, and she'd raise her hand and say, "That's fine, but what about when?" And she would, you know, describe some kind of, you know, amazing event. What would you do then? How does this apply there? So anyway, she was asking me some questions like this last weekend, and it had to do with karma. And she said she had encountered somehow in the hospital this man had been speeding on his motorcycle and had been in a police chase. Police were chasing him. Apparently he was going at 120 miles an hour on his motorcycle. And then he crashed. And he survived the crash with a lot of bruises and a lot of scrapes, but no broken bones. Seems to have managed okay. And then she knew someone else who was a stagehand someplace and was simply took a step backwards on stage, very innocently, you know, fell over. I don't know if he fell off the stage or just fell back, and ended up now being a quadriplegic. Has no use of his arms or legs. And she wanted to know about karma. Is it, you know, why the difference? You know, why is it that some people, you know, who seemingly were breaking the law and they got off quite lightly, and someone else who was just going minding their own business, being quite, you know, this terrible thing would happen to them. And then she extended it to another example. It had to do with a mother who had two children. And every day she would pick up one of her children from school. And she had a particular routine she would do. I think she picked up her first one, and she'd go to the other school to pick up the second one. And that particular day, she decided to do a small errand on the way to pick up before picking up her second child. And her second child was run over and killed at school, waiting for her mom to pick her up. And the second child was actually far away from the road. The sidewalk was up on the lawn, apparently close to the buildings. And someone in their car, big car, it was new or something, and something malfunctioned or something, and the person lost control of the car and drove up on the lawn and ran over the child. And so the mother was racked with all kinds of, certainly regret, but kind of almost guilt. If I hadn't gone done that errand, then my child would be alive today. And, you know, it's taking responsibility. You know, it was up to me. It was me. It was I, you know, almost as if I had done it because I was the one who did that errand. And so she asked about karma, this woman, and telling me about these three stories. How does that karma work? Are we responsible for, you know, is it the working of karma, that the way things work? And where is the justice in this world if someone who's breaking the law can get off so easily, in a sense, and someone who, minding their own business, can break their neck? And how is it karma works, you know, when the cause and effect chain work? And is it the karma of the child to have been killed? Is it the karma of the mother to have a child like that? Or she was asking questions like that. And my response to her was that my understanding of the Buddha's teachings on karma We're not meant to explain why things happen. Even though there's a tremendous drive, we want to know why things happen certain ways. We want to assign fine meaning, local meaning, cosmic meaning, ultimate meaning in these things. One of the drives for meaning is a drive for justice. And part of the function for some people in offering a theory of karma has been in offering a theory of justice, how justice works itself out, that the world is a just place, that if someone does horrific things, that they will meet, you know, they'll reap what they've sowed. Something horrible will happen to them in return. That's where justice works. And but then we don't see, you know, look around, and we watch these people who do terrible things, and they get wealthy, and then they die, and you say, well, where's the justice? And then those people say, oh, well, the justice will happen in the next life, or down the line. And because they were really greedy in this lifetime and did terrible things, they're going to be reborn as a slug or something. There are many such ideas that you find in Buddhism, certainly, and other religions with the notion of karma, to explain how things happen over lifetimes. And I missed a little bit, but yesterday there was this class here, Life of the Buddha, and the handout for the class that showed how there were these things that happened to the Buddha while he was alive, it's recorded supposedly. Like he had a splinter in his toe, and once someone else tried to kill him. Various things, he had a bad back. And so, you know, a Buddha is someone who's supposed to be not only fully enlightened, but fully perfected in all kinds of ways. And in the kind of mythology that's developed around a Buddha, you know, being kind of a saint kind of person, saints become kind of more and more perfected, and the further away you get them from their lifetime. So then there has to be some explanation. You know, how is it someone so perfect got a splinter or, you know, got a bad back? And then the theories were offered, oh, because in a past life, the Buddha did X, Y, and Z. And therefore, so it's a theory of justice that's being offered. There's a tremendous drive for us to want the world to be just. We want just to see justice to occur. And my own understanding, and it's best as you listen to my talk today, that you really take this to be my kind of digestion, my kind of trying to come to terms or trying understanding of this whole thing, and not and really can listen to my reflections, then reflect on your own. And some of your ideas might be very different than my own, but this is my best kind of take on all this. So my understanding then, my view is that the Buddha's teachings are not meant as a theory of justice, and even how much we want that. The Buddha's teachings on karma weren't teachings about why things are the way they are, but were really teachings that help us focus on, given how things are, how do we respond in relationship to them occurring as they are? How do we react? And the Buddha's teaching on karma, as I understand it, really focuses on this central issue of how we are in the present moment. So rather than spending a lot of time analyzing the past or a lot of time thinking about the future, the Buddha's teachings on the karma are kind of like a focal point on what's happening in the present moment and how are we responding to that? How are we reacting to that? What are the choices we make in relationship to that? But that's not to deny that there's an element of a temporal element to the Buddha's teachings on karma, that there's also the past and the future also come into play. But it isn't kind of in absolute terms. And in fact, the Buddha was critical of some of the more absolutist ways of understanding karma. He said very clear, karma simply means action, and it's an extension of karma. Of this word action is how activity unfolds in this universe. So there are various ways in which activity unfolds, where things happen. Theories about it that the Buddha was critical of. One is that that in some ways things are predetermined, absolutely. And even karmic predeterminacy, that because of your past actions, therefore, Y will happen karmically. Any kind of absolutist, deterministic idea that because of in the past certain things happen, something in the future will happen, he wanted to negate. And partly he wanted to do it because he said that kind of view leaves no space for a spiritual life. It leaves no space for trying to make a difference, find liberation or freedom in the midst of this life. The other thing he was critical of was that any ideas that the gods did it. You know, there are gods, some are, you know, India had a lot of gods. We're kind of, nowadays in the West, kind of god poor. We have one. But the idea that some kind of god or gods are responsible for what happens to you was something the Buddha wanted to, was also critical of, partly for the same reason, because if it's up to the gods, then you have very little control over your own destiny, your own activities, your own happiness, unless you do all kinds of things in relationship to the gods. In ancient India, people often sacrifice in relationship to the gods to somehow make the gods happier. And then there'd be kind of an exchange relationship with the gods. And the gods would hopefully, if they were in good mood, would do nice things for you. The Indian gods were kind of like the Greek gods that were the Norse gods. They were also a little bit mischievous. And, you know, they weren't necessarily all good. And so they were kind of moody. The other theory he was critical of is that everything that occurs is accidental. That things just happen randomly, whatever way, and therefore, you know, we don't really have much say about what happens. Just, you know, think accidents happen to us. Things happen randomly, and we have no involvement, no possibility of entering into the stream of activity, cause and effect, and make a change. An interesting place in the suttas, the Buddha says, someone comes to the Buddha, there's wonderful dialogues in the suttas, someone comes and asks Buddha questions or debates with the Buddha. Someone comes to the Buddha and says, is a person, responsible for one's own happiness and unhappiness? And the Buddha said, no, I wouldn't say it that way. Okay, are others responsible for one's own happiness and unhappiness? No, I wouldn't say it that way. Is it that both self and others are responsible for one's own happiness and unhappiness? No, I wouldn't say it that way. Is it that neither selves nor others are responsible for one's happiness and unhappiness? No, I wouldn't say it that way. Well, how would you say it? And the Buddha said in order to understand the causes and conditions for happiness and unhappiness, you have to understand that there's a cause and effect relationship that doesn't have a singular point of beginning or singular point of responsibility. So to say that the self is responsible and only the self is, you know, putting it kind of some singular point of responsibility and denies the field of cause and effect that comes into play. And it's same things if you blame someone else. And so the Buddha didn't want to kind of say that way, this way or that way, but rather wanted to look, what are the causes and conditions that bring about happiness and unhappiness? And the teachings of the karma are part of this quest, they're part of this effort to look at the causal relationships that bring about happiness and freedom from suffering, or cause suffering. And so it's very interesting. The Buddha says, no, don't look at the self as being ultimately responsible. Don't look at others. Don't blame others, but also don't blame yourself. And there was an interesting event that happened in my sister's life, a painful one for her, when she was 14. A friend of hers committed suicide. She spent a day with a friend and then was actually in the apartment building when her friend jumped out the window. And she spent years kind of racked with guilt and feeling that, oh, I could have done something. I could have done something. It was really a burden for her. And then she came across a Zen teacher once and people kept telling her, oh, no, there's nothing you could have done. You know. And that kind of advice didn't sit with her well. And then she had a friend, a Zen teacher, who told her, oh, you know, there probably was something you could have done. But you were only 14. And a 14-year-old probably didn't have the wisdom to understand what that was. And that got my sister to relax. She finally let go of taking that burden, that kind of responsibility. When she realized, yes, there was something she could do, that was true. But as a 14-year-old, you know, that was not something in her domain to be able to figure out what to do. And so there was a place where the Buddha defined karma in his terms. His karma is an Indian term that was used quite broadly in India. Here in the West also is now used. Something happens to you and a person says, you know, it's my karma. And what does that mean? It's my karma. There's a kind of, sometimes kind of almost implied in that, it's kind of predestination kind of approach. You know, it was just destined to happen. It's my karma. There's nothing I could have done. It was my karma. And that's not a Buddhist view. That just was destined to happen. That's my karma. It might have something to do with your karma, what you did in the past, but you have to be very careful in analyzing what's going on. We live in a field, in an ocean of cause and effect. And as a little child, sometimes when I was about, I don't know how old, 10 or so, 9, I used to have a lot of reflections about this field of cause and effect. And some of it relates to this idea of karma. And it was inspired by when I was 6. I brought home to this apartment complex we were living in, this long pole. To me, it was really long. And that evening, there was a kind of a party in the back of the apartment complex. And some grown-up took that pole and tried to use it to pole vault over a fence, a low fence. And it was relatively low fence, as I remember. But in jumping over the fence, he broke his leg. And I thought I was responsible for, you know, again, for the fact that I brought the stick there, right? If I hadn't brought the stick, if I hadn't, then. And so I was thinking, I thought a lot of this cause and effect and the field of cause and effect that we live in. And I used to think about things like, well, if I'm walking down the street and I ask someone for the time of day, it takes the person 2 seconds to offer me the time of day. And then the person continues walking down the street and gets run over by a car, but just barely. Those 2 seconds, you know, the person would have been 2 seconds further across the crosswalk and they wouldn't have been hit. So therefore, am I to blame? But then I would think further, well, you know, I delayed that person 2 seconds. But the storekeeper or the person stopped that delayed the person, you know, 2 seconds also when they couldn't find the change quickly. And pretty soon, you know, it gets very complicated. You know, who was it that was responsible for those 2 seconds? Or the fact that the person was on that street that day, and you know, and pretty soon it gets, you know, we get lost in this huge field of cause and effect. And why would we single out one particular thing when, you know, there's so many different things that come into play? The image I have is, you know, take a pond and you throw one pebble in. You get one ripple kind of going outwards. But if you take, you know, throw a lot of pebbles in, then the ripples start hitting each other. And the ripples hitting each other make further ripples, and you get further ripples, and you get this amazing pattern of ripples. And where's the cause and effect relationship? It's very hard to kind of tease it all apart because it gets so complex the way things bump into each other. So the Buddha looked at, my understanding is that the Buddha then looked at this great ocean or field of cause and effect and picked out one particular area of it. And that area was the area of intention. The cause and effect relationship or the causal effect of our intentions, our intentional actions. And he defined, what I said, Buddha, what I call karma is intention. So rather than calling any activity, any unfolding of activity, karma, he called that activity that has an intentional base. So there are lots of things we do that have no particular intention, things that activities. If you walk out of the center here and there's an ant on the sidewalk and you don't see it, you don't even think about it, and you squash it, the ant, and you continue in your way, you never even knew that you killed the ant. There's no karmic effect for having killed the ant. There's cause and effect relationship for having killed the ant. The ant's dead, The next person who walks out of the center looks at the dead ant, you know, is delayed 2 seconds. And everything else, you know, that person's life changes forever in some way or other. The person goes to the store and buys a lottery ticket, and because it was 2 seconds later, they buy the ticket that wins, and the person lives happily ever after. So there's a call, you know, it sets in motion a causal chain of things to happen. But, you know, you might be oblivious of it because you just continued on your life without noticing the fact that you killed it. So there's no intention in killing the ant. Someone else walks out of the center, sees an ant, and says, oh, you know, great, I hate ants. You know, I'm going to squash that ant, you know. And there's an intention of hate, of animosity, or fear, all kinds of things. And so the person then squashes that ant with intention. That intentionality sets in motion a certain causal chain of effects within us. It's kind of like if you're in water, swimming in water, and you push the water, and some of the water then, you know, gets pushed away, goes away from you, but you also get pushed away also, right? Because it's very clear in the water that any activity you do affects where you are in the water. So you push one direction, you get pushed the other direction. So the activity of the mind, of intentionality, is the same thing. There's an external kind of cause and effect relationship that gets formed, but there's also kind of a back pull or back push that happens. And we could say in our psychologicalized West that it's a psychological effect that happens. Something happens internally with us. And there's many things that could be said to happen. Some of them are pretty simplest, kind of clear, is that, for example, we might reinforce the habit to be hateful or angry. Any particular activity oils the wheels of hate or anger or fear, or oils the greases of generosity and happiness and kindness. So the way in which the intentions we act on affects then the habits in the mind, makes it easier to do other things in the future. Also, the things that we act on, the intentions we have, sometimes can have an effect on the way in which we view the world and see the world. You probably had the experience of being filled with hateful or angry intentions for someone, and it distorted your view of who they were. Or fearful ones, it distorted your view of who they were, who they are. And there's many times in our life when we somehow have fear of people, or sometimes desire for people, and all kinds of ideas about who they are, and it prevents us of seeing who someone really is. So intentionality also can affect our perception of how the world is. And in affecting our perception of how the world is, it then reinforces our tendency in the future maybe to respond the same way. Because sometimes it's self-reinforcing our views. Say we're afraid of someone, and the person picks up on our fear, and then that person gets afraid and gives you reason to be afraid, you know. But if you hadn't been afraid to begin with, it wouldn't have happened. Sometimes our intentionality, the way intentionality and reactions and emotions are very closely related. Psychologists will often say an element of most emotions is intentionality. I wouldn't say all, but certainly a lot of them. There's also the effect on our body. And some Buddhists will put a tremendous emphasis on the embodied consequences of intentionality. That if we react angrily or with afraid or happily or kindly, it affects what happens in our body, the tensions, the holding patterns. So when we're filled with very strong resistance to the world, bracing ourselves strongly against the world, then sometimes this strong tension in the body can develop. It can last a lifetime. And it occurs to me, I don't know if it's a good thing to say, but it just occurs to me, and I apologize. Sometimes you see people right after they died, and you see their faces have relaxed. It's, it's a peaceful death or something, so their face is so relaxed. Partly is because they just relaxed the holding they've had carrying for a lifetime. And they're no longer making that effort, which, you know, is deeply kind of subconscious in the effort they're making. But we hold our intention. We hold the karma, the cause and effect also goes into our body. It's said in Buddhism that the channels in which this kind of karma unfolds over time is often unseen. It can go for a long time before the seed that you've planted bears fruit. So it might be that you kind of reinforce certain tendency to be angry in certain settings. And that setting doesn't occur for 20 years. But then it occurs, and it's right, that seed is right there. And a little bit of anger can create huge disasters in a person's life. It's sometimes said, you know, it can take months or years to make a good friend. And you can lose your good friend in one sentence. You know, if you have a little, if you're not paying attention to what you're saying. So it's this internal cause and effect relationship that has to do with our intentions and the chain of effect that the intentionality sets up that the Buddha is encouraging us to look at and take responsibility for. Because that is where we can add and have some effect on the path to liberation, to our happiness and our unhappiness. You're not going to have an absolute effect because things happen that are kind of outside of our control in this world. Sicknesses are... To say that any sickness you have is your karma, you're responsible in some ways, is not a Buddhist thing to say. To say that accidents happen because of your karma is not a Buddhist thing to say. Because we don't know how the unfolding of cause and effect. But how we respond to the accident, how we respond to the presence of an illness, that's where the locus of practice is. That's where spiritual life occurs, is looking at that and understanding it. And one of the reasons why we cultivate mindfulness is not so that we can be calm, but we cultivate mindfulness so we can have the presence of mind to see in the present moment where the choices are that we can make, where we can make a difference of how we respond, how we react. And then as we look at that place of choice, then maybe we can choose in a way not only that's beneficial for the people around us and for ourselves and kind of external cause and effect relationships, but also what is best for our inner life. What sets the conditions for an inner life that is freer, more at ease, more compassionate, that supports the kind of values that we want to live by. So to look at that place of choice. An example I've given many times, I apologize for the repetition of this, is one day I was coming off the exit, freeway exit at 280 on Sand Hill, and there's a stop sign for everyone there when you come off at the intersection there. And I stopped, and no one else was stopped at the intersection, and so it was clear it was my turn to go. But there was a car coming in from the left, and of course that car was supposed to stop at the stop sign, but the car didn't stop for the stop sign. And I was kind of already going into the intersection. And we missed each other by, it felt like a hair. And I said, well, God, that was good. And then I thought about that afterwards. And I said, well, if we looked at it, if there had been an accident, and we looked at it from a legal point of view, who's responsible? I think the legal responsibility was the person who ran the stoplight or the stop sign. Probably would have been pretty clear. And we could have just left it there. But if I wanted to look at my karmic involvement in that, if you can, the Buddhist analysis of this, then we want to extend it to look at where is it that my intentionality somehow came into play in this kind of event. And there I have to say, oh, you know, I went on my way to teach at the Friends Meeting House, to teach on Monday night, you know, to teach how to be present and calm and mindful and pay attention to your intentions and all that. You know, that's what I was going to teach. And I was a little bit in a hurry to get there, you know, pushing a little bit the gas pedal, just a little bit, just, you know, not dramatically. No one would have noticed who saw me, but I was kind of like, you know, and I hadn't really noticed it until I reflected on after the near accident. Oh, it would have been so easy if I'd just been pushing that gas pedal a little bit more, been a little bit more intent, a little bit more greedy to get there quickly or whatever. We would have had that accident. The person still would have, legally, the other person would have been responsible. And I wouldn't have gotten out of my car and said, oh, let me tell you about my karmic responsibility here. But karmically, I wouldn't necessarily say that my karma, my intentionality caused the accident. It had a contributing effect. But I don't think I would have kind of blamed myself for it particularly. But it was very important to be aware of how my intentionality affected, where it was playing itself out and had an external kind of result in a sense. But what's most more interesting is that the accident didn't happen. But my unhealthy intentionality was still there, still operating. Because there was no accident, am I not supposed to reflect on that? I got away with something. You know, I got away with kind of pushing the gas pedal because I didn't have an accident. The chain and effect of intentionality continues regardless of whether there's the accident or not. Because I was kind of pushing that gas pedal, I was maybe creating a little bit of tension in my shoulders, and because of the little tension in my shoulders, that exasperated a lifetime of tension in my shoulders, and pretty soon my upper back goes out. And the upper back goes out not because of necessarily having a bad back, but because perhaps a lifetime of this intentionality of how I hold myself in relationship to the world. Or it reinforces the fact that it's okay to kind of drive a little bit fast. And so I do it again with the same kind of mindset. And it's that mindset that gets reinforced, that mindset that creates unhealthy conditions that are going to somehow or other come into play or blossom into the future. But we have no idea how they're going to blossom. So the Buddha's spiritual life is meant to be kind of a wedge that goes in between the karmic unfolding of things. Once you set in motion a karmic pattern, it doesn't mean that things are set then, that they have to unfold in a certain way. Certainly they're not going to necessarily unfold in a certain way. They're going to unfold in relationship to what happens around you. And so depending on what happens around you, it might take a different shape, what happens. So it's not like a mechanical, because you drive too fast, therefore this is going to happen to you. Because you kind of are intentionally kind of, you know, greedy in the way you drive, that's going to set up certain conditions that, depending on what those conditions meet in the external world, might not unfold in ways that you don't know. So the practice is supposed to be kind of a wedge where you can make a difference. So we take what's happened to us, and we learn how not to be in conflict with what's happened to us, how not to add more karma by being in an aversive or a clinging relationship to what's already occurred. Because if something has occurred and we hate it and try to push it away, we're creating new karma. But if we cannot be in conflict with what's happened, then that lack of conflict can mean we're not adding more karma to the event. So that's the beginning. And then there's also what's called a little bit the working out of karma. And some Buddhist teachers have put a lot of emphasis on doing that through meditation practice, and in particular doing it through meditation practice that focuses on mindfulness of the body. Because a lot of this stuff gets carried in our body, in our muscles, in our posture. And one way to purify yourself of the karmic, your karma, is to purify your body. And so to sit in meditation and to feel the knots, to feel the holding patterns, to feel these things, and sometimes you feel them painfully, and to be patient with them and let them unravel themselves in the field of awareness, then is some teachers emphasize the kind of purification of that karma. And certainly, you know, I think that if You know, there's a cause and effect relationship between the holding patterns in our body and our intentions and our reactions and responses. If we're tense in our body, we're more likely to respond to the world in further tense ways. So if we can learn how to release the tension being the results of past karma, then we're probably less likely to create new bad karma because we're more likely to be tense. Make sense what I just said? So to some degree, what Buddhist practice requires of us is a level of taking responsibility for ourselves. We're not looking externally for magical solutions to our happiness. We're not looking for the lottery to do it. We're not looking for, gods to do it or the equivalent of it. But rather, the focus is to let's try to be in the present moment enough so we can see, how am I choosing to react? Can I see my choice? It's not easy to see our choices. People who don't see their choices don't have choices. And part of the function of mindfulness is to help us see the place of choice. And slowly, slowly, slowly see how there's more and more choice, and then choose how that we respond. When I came back from spending 3 years in Zen monastery, in Zen monastery, almost everything was choreographed. It's kind of like theater. And how you stand, and how you sit, and how you eat, and how you chant, and how you meet someone on the pathway. It's all this kind of forms that you're supposed to do. So it's very clear what you're supposed to do. But when I left the monastery and was living in San Francisco, there was no more forms. There were there's no one telling me that, this is how you, I'd left the theater, right? So there's no more particular way of being. But because of my 3 years of being in theater, I saw that I had much more choice in simple things like how I sat in a chair than I saw before I went to the monastery. Before the monastery, I just sat down. But after I came back to the monastery, I saw, there's a variety of ways I can sit on a chair. And how do I want to sit on the chair? And sitting in the chair had something to do with my intentionality. So the range of choices I had increased after I was at the monastery. The point of mindfulness is to see where the point of choice is, and then in a wise, kind, compassionate, non-conflictive, non-burdensome way, maybe even a joyful way, beginning to massage and work with and explore the area of choice and reactivity. And it's a fascinating world. And it ties in with so many different things about our lives. It can tie into our belief system. You get to explore your beliefs and your views. And then you share your views with your friends and get some feedback. It can tie in with certainly our past. You can see sometimes how our past affects how we see the present and the choices we make. And that's going to be very helpful to see. It can tie into what we feel is the goal of our life, the point of life, the meaning of life, what we're hoping to get out of life. And we can get to massage and look at that. It addresses the issue of how we're related to other people and what our relationship to other people and how our life affects others and others affect ours. There's a lot of things that unfold as we try to stay kind of seated in the present moment. And the last thing I'll say is that the present moment is such a phenomenally rich nexus of so many different influences and meeting points of so many different aspects of our life that it's probably the most fascinating place to be. I think it's much more fascinating than the two-dimensional world of memories and the two-dimensional world of planning the future. So I hope you all discover the joy of the three-dimensional, four-dimensional, five-dimensional world of the present moment. And I hope that this little discussion of karma is useful and hopefully a little bit clarifying as I offer you the ways I try to clarify it for myself. Okay? Thank you.